Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to hear from an expert who gives us information that is designed to hopefully expand our views, our thoughts, our way of thinking about a particular topic. Now, today we're going to be talking about something that the United States Surgeon General framed at the end of last year as a crisis facing America. And the report was entitled Facing Addiction in America. And the Surgeon General indicated that the opioid epidemic cost the nation $249 billion in lost productivity. With that backdrop, I am very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Constance Scharf, who is an international authority on alcohol and drug addiction. Dr. Scharf has a PhD in transformative studies. She specializes in addiction recovery. She wears a lot of hats. She is the Senior Addiction Research Fellow and Director of Addiction Research at Cliffside Malibu Treatment Center in California. And she is the co-author with Richard Tate of Ending Addiction for Good. Dr. Scharf, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm delighted that you were able to carve out the time. You are a very busy person.
Yes.
Now, you just heard me read some numbers. Have the numbers changed significantly in your awareness since this report?
Well, they're trending in the wrong direction. They're trending up. And it looks like with the changes that are going to be made to healthcare services across the spectrum, whether it's Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, and so on, that people are going to have less access to addiction treatment. So the concern is that we're going to be losing more lives, more productivity, that addiction will be costing us more in the future rather than less.
There's an interesting, just as an aside, it's an interesting way that insurers and others think about treatment in general, but certainly addiction treatment.
Yes.
You began Ending Addiction for Good, which, as I said, you co-wrote with your colleague Richard Tate, with your own personal story. I'd like to start there with your permission.
Sure. So I was born in Fresno, California, which is the heart of the San Joaquin Valley, and my parents were farmers. So I grew up outside of the city, in the isolation of the farm. And not only was it very lonely, but my father in particular was quite abusive to me. And so I grew up with a significant amount of trauma and no one to turn to for help. So by the time I was 11, I don't know what changed that day, but I walked into, my parents had split. I walked into my mother's house where I was living, and my mother was not a drinker, but we had a little bit of alcohol in the house. I poured a little bit out of each bottle so that I had, you know, an 8-ounce glass in front of me, and I sucked it down over the sink, and it was the best feeling of my life because I was like, the problems that I was facing to which I had no solution were resolved, at least in that moment. Because I lived in the country, it was very difficult to access even alcohol. That's no longer the case now. If I was, you know, a young person now, I probably would be dead because heroin opioid drugs are widely available in rural areas now where they weren't then. I was in rural Oregon at that point, which had state-run liquor stores that had very limited hours and were closed on the weekend, and it was, you know, a half an hour drive to get to one. So I'm alive today because of that. And when I was 22, I had finished college with honors and was in the workforce and was a hopeless alcoholic and was dying. I could feel my liver, I could feel my kidneys, and out of the blue, my father died. And I realized at that moment that I had a chance to live a different life because it was very clear to me that I thought I had been drinking because I was afraid of him, but there was no reason to be afraid of him if he had gone. And so I realized that I needed to do something different, and I started the path to recovery. And I'm now 18 and a half years sober.
That is absolutely wonderful. One of the points that you make, as you have just shared with us your own personal story, and you certainly make in the book, is that addiction has its roots in pain and a wish to avoid the pain and the despair. And I would suggest, I'd like to hear your response, that so many times that fact escapes people and they don't think about addiction as an outflow of pain and despair.
Sure. So one of the things that people commonly think of as addiction is that people party themselves into addiction. You know, you think of fraternity boys, right, being that sort of shining example. But most of those people who really are pretty happy and content in their lives and have sort of normal everyday problems going on don't become addicts. And when they get out of college, for using this example, they lose that addiction. So people get confused about what addiction is. Addiction really has two parts to it. There is an underlying pain or trauma that caused the person to use in the first place. Happy people don't become addicts. Then the other part is that the addictive behavior takes over the brain so that a person cannot make good choices anymore. Those two things together, that unresolved trauma and the neurological process in the brain, is what makes addiction so intractable and why treatment is so difficult.
Now, you know that there are many, many people who say that, you know, you started it yourself and you can stop it yourself, that addiction of any kind is the result of some emotional or moral failing. And this notion that, you know, you can't stop because there are changes in the brain, they just don't buy into that. What do you say to those folks?
Well, you can have your own opinion, but you don't get your own facts. The fact of the matter is that the brain is very rapidly changed, especially by these newer drugs, the very strong opioids that we didn't have 100 years ago, right? So, but I think that there's a problem when we start to relegate mental illness of any variety to a moral failing. And the reason that people do that is because addicts behave badly, right? They do show up drunk to the Little League game and the wedding, and they embarrass people and they steal. You know, so people want to believe that that's not beyond their control, right? Because if it's within their control to change that, then you can just write them off as a bad person. If they're really ill, then we have a moral obligation to help them. And I think people are uncomfortable with that.
I would actually suspect that you are very right in that regard. You talked about making the choice after your father died to do something different with your life and with your drinking behavior. What did you do first?
Well, you have to remember that this was over 20 years ago, and I did not get clean right away. It took, you know, about 3 years for me to start really on an abstinence journey of I don't drink or use at all. But I went to 12-step programs because that's what there was. 20 years ago, if you went to a treatment center, it was 30 days of learning about the 12 steps. Or you went to 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, et cetera, and did the program there. That was the option that we had. Now, especially in the last 5 years, there has been so much really incredible research that's been done. We have more options, and so we get better results. You know, I'm class of 1998 is what we call it, my year that we got sober. And there are very few of us when you compare the number of people who went you know, to 12-step programs for the first time in that year. And that's one of the problematic things about 12 steps is it doesn't have the recovery rate that we would like to see. But it does help millions of people, and it helped me.
Would you say that the 12-step programs are still useful today?
Absolutely. Certainly where I work at our treatment center, we do introduce everybody to 12-step programs. And I think what's most important about 12 steps is a lot of addicts burn their bridges. They don't have family support anymore. They don't have community support anymore, and they're really on their own. 12-step programs are everywhere in the world. You can find something pretty much 24 hours a day, certainly 24 hours a day if you include the internet. And these are people who've been through the same thing that you've been through. So they are very supportive of individuals and their recovery. And I think it's a disservice to write that program off completely. I think that what it does in terms of support for addicts early in recovery is fantastic. And about half of the clients at our treatment center enjoy that program or programs similar to it and continue with it after they leave. So I think it's very important.
The treatment center that you reference is the Cliffside Malibu Treatment Center. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And where are you guys located?
Malibu, California.
Okay. That would kind of make sense given the title, huh?
Yeah.
I want to go back to your own experience of working on sobriety. You indicated that it took you about 3 years. So I think about that, and I think about what you just talked about in terms of the length of time that programs are available, and 30 days is almost, in my understanding, a major miracle to get 30 covered days if you're dealing with substance addiction. Is that correct these days?
Yeah, anymore, we can usually get people covered for 7 days, which is pretty much detox, to 45, but 45 includes a step down to outpatient. Insurance companies are forcing people out of residential treatment, in my opinion, too soon. So they might get 1 or 2 weeks, possibly 3 is stretching it, in a residential, and then they're forced to step down to either partially hospitalized care or outpatient.
And certainly for someone who's at a point where they truly are considered to be addicted, that didn't happen overnight. It certainly didn't happen in 10 days or 20 days or 30 days. Often took place over years. Is that a fair statement?
Sure. We have known in the addiction treatment world, and this comes from, you know, SAMHSA and other, you know, major addiction treatment, mental health treatment organizations, that it takes a good 90 to 120 days in residential care to get a firm foundation on recovery. And I recommend, if you can afford it, right, which is the big thing, 30 days or so in residential treatment, and then stepped down to another 3 to 6 months in outpatient. And you're really talking about a full year of intensive recovery services before someone's really got a good foundation. And a lot of that has to do with the way the brain has changed. The brain changes very slowly. And in order for us to make the neurological changes that we need to make and to address those underlying pain issues, we need time. And that's something that most insurance companies do not give us in abundance.
So, again, clearly the 7 to possibly 45 days of coverage is nowhere near what is really useful in terms of truly helping folks who, as you've said, are in a great deal of pain or they wouldn't be where they are.
Correct. The 28-day model or 30-day model comes from insurance. It doesn't come from studies on medical efficacy. comes from insurance. They said, this is what you get. And so that's why those models have popped up. And now, even with the Mental Health Parity Act, we're still not seeing people able to access the care, which is why you see people in treatment multiple times, why you see people who go to treatment relapse and come back 3, 5, 7 times, because they're not getting the care that they need the first time. If they could stay in treatment. I mean, one of the most heartbreaking things for our psychotherapists who oversee the care of people at our treatment center are the people who are begging to stay and can't afford it anymore, and their insurance has run out.
Absolutely.
And we don't know what's going to happen to them.
Yeah. And that certainly brings up the question of burnout for the folks who are working in the field. How do you navigate your awareness of the condition, your awareness of what actual help looks like, up against what people are actually able to do? How do you navigate that for yourself emotionally?
Well, for me personally, one of the things that I've had to do is I am not a licensed psychotherapist, and I do not see clients. I do not see patients individually because I don't have the personality for that. I would become heartbroken every time someone relapses. What I've done is taken my expertise to what I'm strongest in, which is training other professionals. One of the things that we do at Cliffside Malibu is that I come in as the director of research and work with the psychotherapist, provide face-to-face training for them to work on how do we get the most out of the time that we have with these individuals. For example, when you get your license for psychotherapy, you are trained in psychotherapeutic models that are designed to last for years. Excuse me. We don't have years with these individuals. Mm-hmm. We might have 10 to 20 sessions with them, depending on how long they stay in treatment. So we do something that's called brief therapy. And I go to California and train the individuals that, you know, are on the front lines in brief therapy. I also work with our residential staff, again, face-to-face, to help them to learn what it is, how they can help people who are in an emotional crisis, and help them to stay in treatment when they want to quit, when they're caught in that obsession of, I have to get out of here and use. So that's how we do it, is we provide a great deal of support to the frontline caregivers.
You talk about, and I'm going back now to your own personal experiences, you talk about working on your own sobriety, but as you did, your post-traumatic stress symptoms became more acute for you. You were perhaps more aware of them. What was that like?
So one of the deficits of 12-step programs is they don't deal with trauma. That's just not what they're designed for. And to, you know, that's like expecting, you know, a firefighter to come to your house to make a birthday cake. It's just not what they're meant to do. So if you have trauma, you're expected to get outside help. One of the things that we have learned in addiction treatment is that we really need to address the addiction and any co-occurring disorder and about simultaneously. And about half of all addicts have a co-occurring psychological disorder and addiction. The disorders are usually depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, or attention deficit ADHD with or without hyperactivity. Those are the main disorders that we see. And so as I got sober and wasn't, you know, getting the support that I needed for the trauma work that I eventually had to do, I just became a mess, and really had a hard time staying sober, and was quite miserable, to be honest, in my early recovery, because I was so overwhelmed by trauma symptoms.
What were some of the symptoms you experienced?
I had flashbacks. I had what they call, what therapists call body memories, where physically in your body you remember the assault, so you feel the assault over and over again. I would have sometimes 40 of those episodes a day, just one after the other. I was terrified. I had anxiety that was off the charts. I used to attend a Friday night meeting in California that had no seat saving, right? You had to get there and get your own seat. Because I came from very far away, the guy who set up the chairs for years used to save a seat for me, because if I couldn't see the door, I couldn't be in the meeting. I just couldn't sit there. And because of where I worked, I couldn't get there quick enough to get a seat like that. So, you know, just really almost incapacitating issues. And the only place that I was okay was at my job, because I was so busy that it didn't come up. But if you gave me 2 minutes of downtime, I was a wreck.
Dr. Scharf, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue the conversation, Ending Addiction for Good, the groundbreaking, holistic, evidence-based way to transform your life. We'll be right back. Dr. Scharf, despite the very painful beginnings, you ultimately became sober. You pursued and achieved a doctorate degree, and now you are interested in the study of spiritual aspects of addiction recovery. What do you mean when you refer to the spiritual aspects of addiction recovery?
One of the things that we're learning about addiction is that it really is a whole health problem. You don't come in, with, you know, a great physical condition or just a few psychological issues that you need to work out. Addiction is something that affects individuals on all levels. It's a whole health problem. So we have very good physicians who address addiction on the level of the body, what's going on with the body. We have psychotherapists who deal with those underlying psychological issues, traumas, and so forth. And then where I really come into the research is what happens on the spiritual level, and how do we help people to reconnect to the individuals and the world around them in healthy ways.
And why is that important in terms of maintaining recovery?
Because if you're not connected to other people and to the world around you, you're going to go back to the old behaviors, because the pain's going to resurface. Part of the problem of addiction is a feeling of isolation. You know, when I was a kid, I really was physically isolated out on the farm. And I didn't have anyone to talk to about the problems that I was having with my father. There was no place to go. So I went to what I had, which was alcohol. That kind of isolation, whether real or imagined, is very prominent in addiction. Because addiction pushes us away from the people that who care about us, right? And we do bad things to them. You know, we scream at them, we call them names, we steal from them, we might be violent toward them, and that breaks apart families. You can't stay clean in a situation like that. You have to be connected to other people.
And that, I would think, is perhaps one of the scariest, more difficult aspects of treatment, because that really requires self-awareness and vulnerability.
It does, but it's also an incremental process. Most people have what's called in 12 steps a spiritual experience of the educational variety. It's not that white light, wham, I'm clean now and my life is different. It's very much akin to rebuilding trust, and very similar in its process, that, you know, when you do trustworthy things over and over and over again, people begin to trust you again. It's the same kind of thing with spiritual development. As you develop whatever your spiritual practice is going to look like, and it could be just any number of things, you get better at it.
Now, there are folks who hear the word spiritual practice and go into a tailspin for all kinds of reasons. What do you say to those folks who equate spirituality with religion and often a particular kind of religion?
Well, first of all, the spiritual aspect is not something that we're focusing on in the treatment center, right? We're trying to get people physically well enough to get out of bed, right? And we're trying to get them focused on the psychological issues that are facing them so that they can work on that outside of the treatment center in what we call an aftercare plan. So spirituality is something that an individual develops on their own, of their own choosing.
Okay.
And it doesn't happen necessarily as part of the treatment process. So no one in treatment, or in 12 steps for that matter, is going to dictate to you this is what it should look like. At a certain point, addicts say, I felt a hollowness inside, and it could be anything from hiking in nature to yoga to, you know, a religion of their choice, because that's an option too. That they feel like they need to cultivate some sort of connection. And when I say spirituality, I'm really talking about connection to people and the world around us. For me, that happened at 12 years. I was clean for 12 years before I was like, you know what? I really need to go back to my own religious roots. And it was something that I was very comfortable doing. But it didn't happen right away. It was something I chose later because I felt that disconnect and I wanted to be content in my recovery. That's the thing when people say, oh, well, you have this God thing. I'm completely unconcerned by that. If you find at some point in your recovery that you have a disconnect, then you'll find something that works for you to help you feel more connected. You know, we're in Malibu. There are people who come to us who are sailors, and sailing or surfing is that connect. That doesn't sound like organized religion to me, right?
Not at all.
So I use that term very loosely. And when people are concerned about it, because they do hear it in 12 steps right away, I say, we don't have a 12-step based program. That's not what we do. And if you find at some point that that's of interest to you, here are a whole bunch of resources. But it's not something that we push, because we need a person to be well enough. I don't want you to be indoctrinated into something you don't believe in. That's not recovery. I want you to be well enough to make choices that lead you to a healthy lifestyle. Spirituality will probably be part of that, if that's what you choose.
There was a time when if someone presented with a substance abuse issue and trauma, the guidance would be to go deal with the substance abuse issue and then come back and deal with the trauma.
Correct.
Talk about the transition.
Yeah. So what we found is that those individuals invariably relapse. There's almost a zero recovery rate with individuals who do not treat their addiction and their co-occurring disorder concurrently. And so what happens is when you take away the substance, right? So the person stops drinking, as an example, all the traumatic feelings come up, right? That was my personal experience. If you don't have a place to deal with that, you're going to drink, right? You're going to go back to using because you have to deal with those feelings. They're overwhelming. The opposite is also true. If you try to see a psychotherapist, right, which I did in college, on Friday afternoons, I saw the psychotherapist for the last session of the day, and it was a 1 minute, 1.5 minute walk back to my dorm. I was drunk within 5 minutes of that session being over because all the emotional feelings came up, and I didn't have a way to deal with that except to just push them down by drinking. So if you deal with one without the other, then your odds of success are very, very low.
Okay. You go beyond the disease model with
yes.
respect to conceptualization and treatment. You say that it's more accurate to refer to it as a disorder. What's the distinction that you're making? Why is it important?
Diseases are something that you catch, right? Like the flu or malaria, or they can be genetic. What we're any number of hereditary disorders. What we're finding with addiction is that it is neither. It's certainly not something that you catch. It's not in the water or the air. It's also not governed by genes the way we expected to find. Now, genes certainly play a role, right? If you didn't have the genetic predisposition for eyes, if your genes didn't say develop eyes, none of us would have eyes. So genes play a role. But what we think we're going to find with addiction, and this is what we're learning, and this is very much on the cutting edge of the science, is that addiction's more like obesity, that there are some people who really just can't gain weight. And there are some people who get in the vicinity of chocolate cake and pack on the pounds, right? And most of us are in the middle where, you know, if we misuse food in any way, we're going to be a little bit heavy. So we think addiction is like that. And every time you have an environmental reason or a psychological reason, you're going to shift over more towards, you know, the side where you're going to actually get the disorder. We're also finding that from the neuroscience, the brain is physically changed by drug-seeking behavior. So it's not just the biochemical change that you get from bathing the brain in your drug of choice. There's also a structural and functional change that happens in the brain. That's not a disease. And so that's why we make that distinction. And it's really helpful in treatment. And I was just down talking to addicts in the treatment center last week about this. And it seems to be very helpful to them because if they understand that their brain has changed in its structure and function, they tend to develop a little bit more patience with themselves, realizing that they're going to have to do a whole lot of work to change that structure and function into a healthier model. So that's why it's so important to us to just, you know, not fall into the disease model. The disease model makes people feel helpless. Well, I have this disease and I have to manage it and there's nothing I can do. But if I say, you know, actually you have a lot of control over what your brain looks like and your brain health at this point, it helps to motivate people to change.
I wonder if it doesn't also have the ability to reduce shame and blame when you recognize that the brain is actually changing. This is not something you just woke up in the morning and said, I think I'm going to do this or I don't care about that.
Sure. I mean, it really helps us in terms of working with the family, right? Because the family very often expects that the individual is going to go to treatment for 30 days and come out and be cured. They are going to be fixed. And that just isn't the case. You know, there's a saying in 12-step programs that if alcohol was the problem, when I remove the alcohol, the problem should be solved, right? So when we detox a person, that person should be cured, right? If it was a disease, of, you know, alcohol abuse. But what we find is that actually the person gets a little bit worse, right? For the couple of weeks right after, they get very agitated. They're very frightened. A lot of anxiety tends to come up when they don't have this drug to deal with their feelings. So it helps families to understand that this is a process. And unfortunately, changing the brain is like losing weight. It just doesn't happen quickly. Doesn't matter how good, you know, you do. Doesn't matter how well you stick to your diet. You're just going to lose weight in a gradual way. The same thing is true of changing the brain. It's like building new muscles, right? If you want to be a bodybuilder, that doesn't happen in 2 weeks. And so that's why we encourage people to be patient and really understanding that this is a biological process that we're working on, not just somebody who behaves badly.
The subtitle of addiction, Ending Addiction for Good, contains the word holistic. And I note that you have also often given reference to yoga, meditation, and your own personal experience, acupuncture. How are those helpful when dealing with addiction?
So particularly with meditation, there's been a lot of funding of meditation studies. We have found, and this is when I say we researchers, I'm talking about Harvard and UCLA and other top research institutions. The neuroscientists there have found that meditation actually grows new brain matter. New gray matter in the brain grows. So through meditation, we are able to change the structure and function of the brain in positive ways. Just like through the drug-seeking process, we are able to change the structure and function of the brain in negative ways. So yogic breathing, the breath work associated with yoga, not the postures, the meditation, that actually changes brain function. So we incorporate that across all levels of treatment, from early, early detox all the way through to people like me who are, you know, 18 and a half years into the thing, still do those practices to keep the brain healthy and lively. Acupuncture does something a little different. First of all, it's one of the few very well-researched alternative pain management alternatives to opioids. And I first learned about acupuncture back when I was, oh gosh, in my early 20s, late teens, early 20s. My grandpa used to use it for arthritis, and it helped him tremendously. So there's been, since then, a whole bunch of research on acupuncture for pain management. And it's a good alternative, for especially for people with chronic pain, because opioids are intended to be used only for short periods. Acupuncture also works on the energetic pathways of the body. It calls them meridians, and that there's this energy that they call chi. And what they do with that is, acupuncturists, is they understand that those energetic pathways get blocked, misaligned, skewed, and they try to get them in balance so that the body heals itself. It's a principle of self-healing that needs a little bit of a nudge. Very effective and well-researched. One of the things that I'm very committed to at Cliffside Malibu, and when I speak internationally, is to share treatment methods that are heavily researched and that have few to no side effects. So let's say you're not very good at meditation and you try to do it and you sit there for 3 minutes and fall asleep. What's the downside? You had a little nap, right? You'll try again tomorrow. you know, with acupuncture, I mean, really, they're in extremely small needles. They're literally hair thin. You might get a bruise, a small bruise. I mean, so we're really looking at what are the negative impacts versus the gain. And those are the whole health models. Those are the therapies that we choose to implement. Very little negative side effect, much gain.
Dr. Scharf, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk more about change. You spend some time in Ending Addiction for Good talking about the process of change. So I'd like to pick up there after the break. Folks, don't go away. We'll return in just a minute. Us through the stages of change. It's clearly not something that happens by magic or overnight.
Sure. So I got my PhD in transformative studies, and everybody says, what is that? It's really the study of change. How does change occur in any population or the environment or an organization or whatever? And I specialize with addicts. And in that research, I came across Dr. Prochaska and his colleagues, Norcross and DiClemente, and they wrote a book, Changing for Good, and they identified that change happens in a fairly predictable way. And it's basically a stair-step model. People can backtrack. It's not necessarily, you know, unidirectional. And what they also did is they identified at each of these stages, what are the obstacles to change? What keeps people from going forward? Which we find tremendously useful in helping addicts. So the beginning of the change model is what they call pre-contemplation, which we call denial, right? The person doesn't know there's a problem. And you and I both know people like that. They have some sort of problem. It could be financial, it could be substance abuse, it could be anything, and they just don't see it. Right. That's where we start. And then we take people through the change process until they're, you know, where I am, which we call maintenance, of, you know, just recovery is part of their lives and they do certain things, not because they're afraid of relapse, but because it makes us feel better. I feel better when I do the meditation. I feel better. My life is better when I do yogic breathing and those things. So that's the spectrum.
So it seems like there's a long walk between denial and maintenance.
Yeah, that's an understatement, yes.
What's after you're dealing with denial? Well, first of all, if you're really steeped in denial, moving out of denial, I would think would be a bit of a tug, if not a huge tug.
But that's what the intervention is for, right?
I see.
Where someone, you know, we sit someone in a chair and we fill the room with the people that they care about. It's not the people who love them. It's the people that matter to them. Right? And we say, hey, dude, this is a problem and you need to face it because we're not going to let you deny it anymore. And I mean, that's really the foundation of what an intervention is all about. So yes, you know, it is a very eye-opening process. You know, it's like, have you ever seen the show Hoarders?
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's like, they call it clutter blindness. they don't see or don't react to the information the way you and I would, that the house is full of stuff. It's exactly the same thing. We have to help that person to see that there's a problem. And one of the ways that we do that is by saying, we're not going to enable you anymore. That you're going to have to feel the full consequences of this issue on yourself without our support.
And with that in place, it kind of makes the slide into contemplating change, I would think, not easy, but easier.
Easier. So then we have, we have pre-contemplation, and then we have contemplation. And contemplation is sort of the best example I can give is the guy who sits on the bar stool at the bar and says, boy, I have a drinking problem, and this is, this just blows. And then 2 years later, he's like, yeah, I still have a drinking problem, and my wife left me, and I lost my job, and I'm having these health problems. But he's too afraid to do anything about it.
Okay.
And so we have to address that fear. That even though your life is horrible, you know it. It's comfortable in the sense that it is known, right? When I was drinking, I knew that I was going to be sick all day and probably, offend two or three people and whatnot. But I understood what my day was going to look like. I was going to get up. I was going to drink. I was going to go to work. I was going to drink. I was going to come home from work, and I was going to get absolutely blotto. That's what was going to happen. It was comfortable because it was known. So the person in contemplation, we have to help them to overcome that fear and say, you know what, your life is worth living, and we're going to help you do that. So then the next stage is preparation, right? All right, now I'm willing to at least listen to what you have to say about change, and this is how I'm going to prepare for that change. Right? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. But how would mm-hmm. one prepare? What would you do?
So that's where you're in the treatment center, right? And whatever, whatever treatment center you go to, or outpatient or 12 steps or whatever. And you say, right, I come home at night and my partner drinks at 5 o'clock. And that's a real trigger for me. What am I going to do when I leave this place? And at 5 o'clock, my partner wants to drink. And we say, okay, so this is, dealing with triggers. And so we say, right, what are we going to do to deal with triggers? How are you going to deal with that? You're going to go to a New Year's Eve party that's put on by your boss, because that's what happens in your organization. And traditionally, everybody drinks. What are you going to do? How are you going to deal with that? Do you have to go to it? Okay, if you do, what are you going to do? So that's what preparation is all about. Is finding the ways that you can change your life and stay clean. So then you get to action where you actually implement it. And you say, right, at 5 o'clock, when my partner wants to drink and isn't going to change that, I'm going to go to the gym, go to a 12-step meeting, cook dinner, walk the dog, whatever it may be, so that you aren't pulled back into your old neurological patterns. That's what we're trying to avoid. While we're building the new patterns, we have to keep you from slipping back into the old ones. So that's what the preparation stage is about. And then action, you put it, you implement it, and you say, okay, this is what we're doing now.
And the maintenance stage?
Maintenance is when you really have had a change in brain function, and it just becomes part of your normal life. So I no longer don't drink because I have to, right? Or I think that I just don't drink because I don't drink. I imagine it's like being a vegetarian. You don't eat meat because you just don't eat meat. And when I've had really horrible things happen in my life, I was very, very sick at one point. I nearly died. And drinking was not a thought that came to me. I didn't think, oh, I should drink and that, to deal with the sadness and the pain and the unknown. I thought, wow, this really, I need to get on to my healthier things to try to help me to not be so depressed, as opposed to let's just drink on top of this. So it just becomes a way of life. Prochaska and his colleagues call it termination, actually, that the change is fixed. But we all know that, you know, you could stop smoking for 15 years and then start smoking again. So we don't use the termination stage. We just use maintenance and say, no, you know, at a certain point, do you want to live a healthy life or not? And if you do, that's why you do these things.
The idea that you can go through these steps, go through this process, and come out on the other side being whole, more whole than perhaps ever, more aware of your life and your surroundings, kind of scary for some folks.
Well, it's terrifying, especially, you know, if you're in your first 30, 60, 90 days of recovery. But that's not what we focus on. You know, we don't focus on 40 steps down the road, 20 years from now. I mean, I've been in recovery, you know, trying to get clean or clean for over 20 years. So we don't compare where I am with someone who's newly in recovery. I say to them, you know, why do we feed you very nutritious foods? One of the things that we do at Cliffside Malibu Foods, we focus on very nutritious foods for individuals, a lot of organic food. It's all prepared by chefs. I said, why do we do that? Because if I fed you fast food and ramen noodles, right, it would undercut your physical health and you wouldn't be able to do the other work. So we take it back, you know, to a way different level, you know, and people are like, oh, that's why we don't get whatever, you know, junk food they're craving. Right. That's why you don't have. I'm like, that's why we don't have that. I want you to be healthy. So what can I do? Because the stages of change are all about meeting a person where they are. And what's going to work for me at 18 and a half years clean is not going to be the same thing that's going to work for someone who's been, you know, clean for 21 days. And so we meet people at their level of readiness for change. And wherever their mindset is. So it doesn't make any difference to me whether you are in denial and really just don't recognize that you have a problem, or you're that guy sitting on the bar stool saying, woe is me, woe is me. I understand that. And I just want to incrementally move you forward.
So I'm not hearing any shame or blame. I'm not hearing any judgment. You are where you are. Let's start there.
Absolutely, because what do you have to be ashamed of, right? If you've suffered, I got into addiction research because I was about 10 years sober and going to 12-step meetings. And where I went to that Friday night meeting happens to be very close to the VA in Los Angeles. And I was seeing men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were dying because they weren't getting the addiction treatment that they needed. Now, things have changed at the VA. This is not an indictment of the VA at all. They were doing what they knew how to do at the time. But I was miserable in my recovery because I wasn't getting the trauma support that I needed. These people were dying, and I said, there has to be something better, right? So coming back to and that's why I went to grad school and looked at the research, and we found that something better. But it wasn't coming from addiction research, so we had to communicate it, right? We had to say, hey, there's all this treatment that's better out there, and communicate it to addiction, you know, professionals. That's basically what I do. I'm the conduit. But coming back to, you know, the idea of shame, those veterans had nothing to be ashamed of. Their trauma came from, for the most part, from battle. The ones that I was working with and seeing die, and because they either relapsed and overdosed or killed themselves. So there is nothing to be ashamed of. If you have had such a hard time and no resources to support you, what do you have to be ashamed of? That's blaming the victim, right?
Right.
And so if I say, hey, I've got a way to help you to be a productive member of society who's not the mistake about not treating addiction the way it should be treated the first time is that the addicts then go out, if they don't overdose, which they're very likely to do with opioids, if they don't overdose, they keep coming back to treatment. They keep using these social resources. And it's not just the medical care that they need. It's the social services for their children, and it's the support for the family and all those things. Whereas if I really give you a shot, most addicts will take it and they will say, hey, yes, I want my family back. I want to be a contributing member of society. I want to pay taxes, right? All of those things. They're people who are, I don't know if you want to use the word sick or broken or however you want to phrase that, right? They're people who need help. And if we help them, overwhelmingly, they become contributors. And that's what we're trying to do. I can't do that if I sack a person with shame.
Right. And your reference to the idea that really what we would be doing is blaming the victim, I think it's really important for those who think about, I mean, it's an important reality, period, for all kinds of reasons with all kinds of populations. But certainly with those who are dealing with addiction, it seems to me that it's very important that those who see themselves as not addicted recognize that when they do the judgment and the negative judgment, that what they're really doing is blaming someone who has been victimized. They are, in effect, re-victimizing that person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the tragedy of that is that it keeps the individual from seeking treatment. And then that individual either is constantly needing care from family or community, and their children, because remember, most people have children, their children then suffer that and need all sorts of supportive services that, frankly, we don't give them. And so you've got, that's where this lineage, this family line, it's not genetic, this family line of addiction comes from. And we can break that. We absolutely can break that. And it just really means being compassionate, you know, because most drug addicts, when they're not absolutely out of their mind's high, are not jerks.
Right.
They don't steal. They don't, you know, tell off their mothers or hit their fathers or ignore their children, right? And so that's their normal state. That's what I always try to communicate to people. That's who the individual really is, and we need to help them to be there rather than judging them. You know, we don't judge someone with dementia and say they're a bad person because they don't remember me.
It's true.
It's exactly the same kind of brain dysfunction. The only difference is I actually have a way to treat the addiction. I can make that better.
Dr. Scharf, who is the co-author with Richard Tate of Ending Addiction for Good, the groundbreaking, holistic, evidence-based way to transform your life. Thank you very much for joining us today. And I would suggest broadening our understanding of the addiction experience and the process of change.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. And I'm wondering if there is a website or a way that folks can get more information about the work that you're doing.
Sure. You can find out more at cliffsidemalibu.com.
Okay. Terrific. cliffsidemalibu.com. Thank you again, Dr. Constance Scharf, so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk comes to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that email is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And that's mindtalk.org. You can always go to the mindtalk.org website to listen to any Mind Talk program. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or from the Google Play Store. Folks, I just want to remind you once again, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.